Welcome to the Stockyard Sessions podcast from Atlas Ag, the team behind Atlas Carbon and Meyer Grazing. My name is Matt Peacock. This is episode 6, The Pioneer. And my guest on the podcast today is none other than Charlie Arnott. Charlie, welcome and thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
Matthew, lovely to be here and thank you for taking the time to chat.
I've been looking forward to this. Now, Charlie is an award-winning 8th Australian generational farmer, educator and advocate for regenerative farming and wellness practices, whose family farming business developed under Charlie's guidance from a conventional industrial high-input mixed enterprise farm working against nature to a biodynamically principled, holistically managed farm partnering with nature. Now, Charlie, that was quite a mouthful for me to say. Can you break that down a little bit for me, please?
I think you did well, Matthew. Yeah, so I've been farming all my life here at Hanamino. Well, I went away to school and university and did other things, of course, in my life. But essentially, I always knew farming was going to be my thing. And when I grew up here, Mum and Dad had a conventional farm, which you referred to. So conventional meaning, you know, a lot of chemical use, a lot of high input, high output, I guess. In my time here as a child and also managing, chemical use increased a lot and less ploughing, of course, but then also animal health stuff increased in terms of what we were using. So not saying that was a bad thing. It's just that, you know, at some point there I decided to change things, and then through a period of time, and really I'm still changing things. You know, you never really finish, hopefully you never really finish your trajectory, your journey. But we did some holistic management courses. We've changed the way we do things. We partner with nature more than we certainly did back then. We consider nature to be a business partner of sorts. You know, the most powerful, sometimes forgiving, sometimes unforgiving, constant business partner that you could have. And we use biodynamics, and we use no chemicals on our paddocks. We do use some conventional drenches for animal health and so on, but you know, I'd have to say it's a very different looking business from what we used to do. You know, we don't crop anymore, so you don't see plough paddocks and bare paddocks and that sort of thing. But look, that's all happened over 20. That change is still happening, but you know, we probably started 20 years ago.
I think nature as a business partner is a really interesting way to look at that. Now, we've dubbed you the pioneer for this episode, Charlie. I think due to your early adoption of regen farming management practices, when did you first start to think about that? Well, you just said, you know, 20 years ago. What were some of the attitudes and feedback towards you and that way of farming at that time?
Matthew, I'd say I'm more of an early settler. You know, if you think about the explorers, and then the pioneers who followed them, and then the early settlers. I feel like a bit more of an early settler. I mean, Landcare was probably the first step into that foray, where you're thinking a bit more about the environment and planting more trees and, you know, fencing off erosion gullies. That's probably the first step into that. And my father was doing that. Burra had started the second Landcare group in Australia back in 1989. That attitude in this district is, you know, it's been here for a long time. Where I sort of stepped further, well, not further away, but the direction towards regenerative farming, that started probably it's about 2004, you know, when I did a grazing for profit course, and I knew some people who'd done it, and they said it's just, you know, fantastic, and I went to some workshops, and anyway, I did their full RCS, Australia's sort of 3-year program after grazing for profit, and then from then on it was one of those things where I couldn't really, you can't unknow what you see and what you hear and what you listen, you know, you understand. And we kept on that journey. And I've probably always been considered not a weirdo, but just, you know, doing things differently. You know, Dad was one of the first people to do, you know, no-till cropping around here. You know, he's into his land care stuff. And then when I took over management here, we continued doing that. You know, we were probably the first in this area to try chemical shearing, you know, which I don't think is a very good idea now, but you know, we're always looking for different things, novel ways to do things. And I don't know, it's you know, where do we sit in the society here, or in the culture of farming? I don't really know where I sit, but comfortably, I have to say, you know, I feel pretty comfortable about it all. You know, it's funny, you know, I've had employees here, and it's happened to me too, and the pub and a few locals might have a few beers under their belt and they sort of sidle up and say, what's all this stuff you're doing out there? You know, they won't ask you when you're sober, but when they've had a few grogs, they're happy to talk about it. and so am I. But anyway, yeah, no, I've never felt that it was not the right thing to do or that I was an outlier, really.
That's great, Charlie. And we'll talk more about farming. We've got lots to cover. I also want to talk about your soil carbon project with Atlas Carbon. But I just want to pick up on your point around your dad and reflect a bit on you and your family. So it was your dad who moved away from biscuit making, which obviously the Arnott name is synonymous with, to farming. He took that step for the family?
Yeah, he did, Matthew. He was his father, my grandfather, was general manager of the Homebush factory in Sydney. And Dad went straight from school into the factory for 8 years and did an apprenticeship there. But he always loved going away, you know, to the family, where his mother's family farm in Queensland, and he loved going there. And he'd always loved that experience, the farming experience. It was probably obligation. He really went straight to the biscuit factory from school, but 8 years down the track, he decided he didn't want to continue that. So farming he went, and he did a few years at the family farm in near Dhurrumbandy, in Queensland, and then Mum and Dad bought the Hanamino in 1970, and then picked farming up here as a conventional mixed farm at Burrawa, you know, sheep, cattle, cropping, and then that's where I picked things up, you know, some years later when I came back from uni and started managing the business.
In terms of managing the business, you've talked in the past about focusing on what you're able to control directly, a part of the job that you say farmers are getting much better at. What do you mean by that, Charlie?
I can't speak for everyone, but I mean, you can apply the same principle to life, really. As I have finally grown up a bit, you sort of, you understand you've only got so much time and so much space in your head, and to fill it with things that are out of your control and worry about those things is really not the best use of one's time or energy or resources. So what's out of our control in farming? Well, it's how much rain falls, how much sun we get. Are there going to be bad bushfire season in the district? Market forces and market price, the cost of inputs. There's so much out of our control that we have and do, understandably, spend a lot of time worrying about and thinking about. But when it all boils down, there's so much of that that you can't change it, and you're not worrying about it's not going to change it, of course, but, you know, in the instance of, say, rain, we can't make it rain, but what we can do is prepare for when it does rain and how do we best utilise that rain? You know, how can we accumulate that rainfall in the profile? Those sort of things. And so I know, you know, it's taken me years, really, to appreciate that, you know, applying a pretty strong filter to not worry and not think about, not so much not think about it. You can always think about it, but don't worry about those things out of your control. Because when we think about it, you know, I don't know if there's any other industry on the planet that has so much, is made up of so many elements and facets of the business which is out of our control. Primarily the weather is one of the biggest ones, of course. But there is also, when you think about so much that is in our control, you know, how we respond. And that's not just about how much ground cover you have to accumulate rain. That's just how do you respond to any situation. You know, you can, you know, respond negatively. You can choose to respond positively. You can reflect. And you start getting into the psychology of thought and decision making and so on. And I've become much better at that, I have to say. And it's, you know, it's the last few years I've become much more considered, mm-hmm. and more reflective, and yeah, it's a bit of a cliche, but cliches are around because they're a fact, they're the truth. You know, like me, but I've got a 5-minute gratitude journal I fill out every morning and night. It's changed my life. I can't tell you how much it's improved my thought process and my attitude and my perception or my perspective. You know, so I've veered a little away from your question there, Matthew, but getting back to it is this. Focusing on what you can control gives you so much more time back, so much more space in your head, because that's expensive real estate up there. We've only got so much of it. So the perspective, you know, on anything, whether it's the markets and how we respond, the weather, relationships, family relationships, you know, neighbour relationships, those sort of things. Yeah, it's the sort of stuff I wish I'd learned at school, or that there was some, you know, when as a young man that I had been trained in just simply how to think in a more productive and positive way.
I think that's brilliant. I might start my own gratitude journal, thanks to you, Charlie. I think that's a fantastic idea.
Well, if you just Google, if you just, I mean, just for the listeners, it, like, I think it's the 5-minute journal. I don't get any commission for this, but I tell you what, it's such a wonderful thing, such a simple thing. It's hard to imagine that such a simple 5-minute exercise in a day can change the 12, 15 hours that you spend awake in that day, and probably helps you sleep a bit better at night too. So it's one of the best investments I've made.
All right. Well, my chat with Charlie Arnett might be my first entry. There you go. I've been looking at your website in preparation for this interview, Charlie, and there's a passage I really like where you say, like it or not, we are all foodies. The relationship we have with our environment and the decisions we make relating to our health and well-being and that of our environment are increasingly important. Do you think, Charlie, people are starting in general to understand that statement, or are there still too many barriers when we think cost of living or vested interests of big commercial food producers? Or have you seen a shift over time?
Look, there's definitely a shift. I think the appreciation of the quality of food from a health point of view, you know, and quality, you can't produce quality food in a sick environment. So people's appreciation of the necessity to look after the environment, to grow that quality food, I think that's definitely increasing, which is wonderful. You know, at the same time, I think there's also, you know, the cost of good quality food, market forces, monopolies. There are other forces that are making the practical application of that appreciation probably a little more difficult. You know, whether it's access to food, you know, good food, whether it's, you know, and of course the cost of that food, or it's what you might call, I don't like the word misinformation, but just the agendas that, you know, perhaps some food producers have, which kind of downplay the benefits of health in food and that sort of thing. I don't know if it's so much a race, and I don't know who's winning, but the good news is that, you know, people are becoming better at telling their stories, especially, you know, farmers and people who, you know, I often start any talks I do with the question, you know, put your hand up if you eat food. And, you know, it is important, and I think it's a natural thing for people to be curious about the food, especially if they're conscious about their health. And look, if they're not conscious about their own health, they should be conscious about their children's health, because they're basically solely responsible for that up to a certain point. So you know, being curious about it's a really important thing and a critical thing. Social media is helping get the message out. I think, as I said, farmers are better at telling their stories through social media. I think that's of interest, and it can be very entertaining and educational at the same time. And that's been one of the good. That's, you know, one of the good things about social media. I often struggle to find other good things about social media, but I think that's one thing: is if people are treat it with respect, there can be a wonderful educational platform. And of course, that helps people sell more product. You know, and it encourages people to come to rural communities, and there's so many benefits of doing that. So I think that, you know, the tide might be turning a bit, but you know, it's not all one way.
You're listening to the Stockyard Sessions podcast from Atlas Ag. My guest on the podcast today is Charlie Arnett. Charlie, let's talk about your soil carbon project with Atlas Carbon. Can you go back to the start? How did that all come about?
We've been using my grazing app for 6 or 7 years now. I couldn't be sure, but so my association with Meyer Grazing and Cole Phelan and his team, you know, goes back some years. And I have done some work with Impact Ag, you know, sort of sister business there. And I guess with relationships developing in both those businesses and being curious about the carbon market and you know, the process of carbon sequestration and so on, and being a farmer, it made sort of more perfect sense for me to research and look into it. You know, I went to my first carbon farming, I guess you'd call it a carbon farming meeting or seminar or gathering in about 2006 or seven and young. And for the next 15 years, I probably was just as confused about it as I was when I stepped into that meeting. You know, it was not clear, and I stayed on the periphery of it all, really. I appreciated the benefit of sequestering carbon, you know, grazing management and pasture production and building soil carbon, the benefits of that in so many different ways. But I guess it was as discussions developed with Cole and, you know, the Atlas Carbon became a thing, it kind of felt quite comfortable and quite logical to sort of develop that relationship with people I knew and respected and trusted as much as anything to step into a carbon project.
So how did the carbon project get underway? There was the farm visit process and what were the steps involved with that and then directly after that?
There was the initial blueprint meeting we had, which was, I'm trying to think, maybe 12 months now, wouldn't be 18 months ago. And then we had, so that process, Bart Davidson came out for, I think it was mostly a full day, and he took a number of samples from paddocks. I can't remember how many, it might have been 20 or so, and that was really to get a base, not a baseline, I shouldn't use that word, it'll confuse things. That was to really get a understanding of the capacity for our landscape to sequester carbon. So Bart Davidson did a farm visit 12, 18 months ago, and that was really to understand the capacity of our landscape to sequester more carbon. So I did some soil sampling. He got the, I guess, the lay of the land, you know, understood, you know, through lots of questions, you know, about some of the history. He obviously had the Meyer grazing data to look at. He basically cased out the joint to see, you know, where was the native pasture, where was the improved pasture, you know, sort of different parental rock sort of thing. And then that was the on-farm thing. And then, you know, there's a huge amount of desktop research done, I understand, by the team. And so that created a report which identified that it'd be worth us doing a carbon project with some estimates of, you know, what we'd be able to sequester and then some forecasting or estimates of the financial benefit of that.
Yep.
And then were some of the areas of our farm that we didn't put under a carbon project, actually, that Bart decided would just probably didn't quite have the potential. Not because it was huge amounts of organic matter already, it was probably because it was going to take a lot of work in that particular sort of shaley country to actually get it to improve and sequester a heap of carbon in there. So it was a great project, bit of an eye-opener for us, you know, getting some sort of fresh soil samples done after many years of not getting soil samples done. And then, yeah, feeling confident that starting that process and that making that commitment was going to, in theory, it's all theoretical until you can start measuring again, that we could actually sequester more carbon and accumulate some ACCUs.
So when do you measure again? Like, where are you up to with the project, Charlie? What happens next?
Yeah, we did. So after that blueprinting process, we had some baseline measurements done early this year, probably February, March. And a month or so ago, I think those results were all pulled together. We're sort of going through them with the Atlas Carbon team at the moment. And it's identified again that, you know, there's some improvements we can make. So not just, you know, there's room for us to improve organic matter or organic carbon in our soil, but also the blueprint comes with recommendations. Actually, that's the bit I did forget. It comes with recommendations on how to increase that uptake and that accumulation of carbon, sequestration of carbon. In our case, it was some slight changes to grazing management, some intensification of grazing, so putting up some more fences, making smaller paddocks, but also a recommendation on some lime from memory, also the application of superphosphate to increase sulfur and phosphorus levels, which is going to help increase the growth of pasture to then obviously, you know, create more pasture that gets eaten by more cattle to sequester more carbon. And so I think there's manure in there as well, that there'd be some benefit in some paddocks to apply manure or compost at least. So essentially it helped identify how we can, you know, some of the tactics we can put in place. And so we are having a meeting with the Atlas Carbon guys in the next couple of weeks to look at that, you know, how we're going. We have already applied some superphosphate. You know, that was a big thing for me, actually, Matthew. For 20 years, we didn't apply any super. I just had this thing about inputs, you know, and I didn't think it was going to be as good for soil health and fungal growth and that sort of thing. And I really battled with that recommendation, but I sought advice from a few other agronomists who I respect, and it was pretty clear that we needed to get phosphorus levels and sulfur levels up. And there's a number of ways to do it and time frames that you can work in, and we wanted to do it quickly. So we put out superphosphate, not at a huge, you know, massive amount, but enough that should trigger some improvement there in those levels, and accompanied by some biofertilizers and biodynamics to help soften the impact on the fungal growth in the soil as well. We're very, very conscious of that. So recommendations have been started to put in place. We're holding a field day here in a couple of weeks' time on the 10th of December. So we're going to be chatting about that on the day, and I'm meeting with Bart and Amanda and Cole the day before too. So things are ramping up a bit in terms of the frequency of meetings we're having and sort of getting the rubber on the road. It's been great. It's taken a while, but this process does take a while to line everything up. And of course, everything has to comply with government regulations and the appropriate government agencies that are running the show. Yeah.
We'll talk more about that field day before the end of this interview. So if that's caught any listeners' attention, please stay with us and we'll cover off a bit more about the field day towards the back end of this interview. Charlie, you mentioned ACCUs there. So in your mind, are you thinking about selling ACCUs, or is that not really a consideration at that point, at this point, and it's sort of secondary to the other benefits of sequestering more carbon in your soils, like improved productivity, financial resilience, obviously climate resilience, etc.? So where's your thought process around that?
You can't look for the shade of a tree if you haven't already planted it, you know, and sometimes that has to happen many, many years before. So I guess there's a couple of things in the thought process that got us to a point of deciding what we would do this. And one is what we were doing already in theory is, you know, improving the environment, improving soil quality and the products that we're producing. And so why wouldn't we just tweak that and potentially sequester more carbon with that tweaking? It wasn't a huge change in direction for our business or our activities. And so I was like, well, let's just get some good advice and do things a little better. And that would give us the opportunity to accumulate the ACCUs if we accumulate carbon. And so with that improvement in what we're doing, you know, the potential there is to with those with that tweaking, and then by having more carbon in the soil, theoretically we'll grow more grass and run more stock anyway. So from a production point of view, it made a lot of sense doing what we've decided to do in terms of taking on this carbon project. Has not compromised what we do in our business and our production. It's just highlighted the importance of getting it right and doing it better, if anything. In terms of, you know, how I feel about sequestering carbon as a climate solution, I don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about that aspect of it. I mean, I guess, you know, I talk to a lot of farmers and, you know, there can be a lot of guilt of people thinking that as farmers who are influencing the environment with our farting and burping cows and so on, that, you know, we're guilty or we have some responsibility to save the planet by doing these things. I think that's just too much responsibility. I always say to farmers, just worry about your own boundary of your own farm, because that's what, getting back to the control thing, that's what you can control. You can make those decisions which steer your business and your production system to, you know, a better health through simply, well, not simply by, but primarily by improving soil health. So the climate solution thing's not high on my list of things, because I just think it's just too vague, you know, focusing on what I do well and doing it better, producing good food, looking after the environment at the same time. The ACCUs and the potential to sell those is the icing on the cake of sequestering more carbon, which will have a positive impact on my business, for me and the environment, and for the food we're producing. I think that's where I focus, you know, and that's all in my control. And I think that's how I sort of came to the decision to do the carbon project.
That's brilliant, Charlie. If a farmer who's in the pub and had a couple of beers and comes up and talks to you and asks for your advice about starting a soil carbon project, what would you say?
I'd say take your time, do the research. You know, there's a number of obviously service providers in starting that project. I'm sure there's a few bushrangers out there as well. So I'd always say proceed with caution, understand why you're doing it, and understand what changes you'd have to make to your business to qualify for a carbon project or to commit to a carbon project. It's not something, I don't think it should be something that you're not in the business of generating ACCUs, I don't think, as a farmer. You're in the business of producing food and looking after the environment in the process, which is increasing, you know, soil health. As I said, ACCUs are the icing on the cake. You know, I'd certainly, if someone had approached me, I'd always recommend Atlas Carbon as someone to go to and have a chat with, 100%. But, you know, it took me 20 years to, well, not quite 18 years from that first carbon league to sort of pull the trigger. I wouldn't expect everyone to take that long. But, yeah, it's not something you want to just jump into. And you got to think about legacy and, you know, to 20, 25-year timeframes. And so you've got to think about, you know, what do your children think about that, tenure of your land and that project. I put a lot of thought into that, into the future, because it is such a long time frame and things can change. You know, family dynamics can change, government legislation can change, cost of production, and so many things can change in 25 years. But we don't know anything about next 25 years or, well, what's going to be in the next 25 years. So I wouldn't use that as a reason not to do it. I think it's just about being aware that you are committing to something for a long time, which has the potential to be very beneficial, you know, if you do it well. And again, you know, Atlas Carbon are great at giving me the confidence that through their blueprinting process that, you know, it's worth us taking on this carbon project.
Fantastic, Charlie. What an ethos and great advice for other farmers. I want to just step away from the farm quickly. And you alluded to this earlier. You know, you're very active on social media. You have your own very successful podcast. I've followed you being an advocate for the beef industry over many years. You know, why is that important to you? And how satisfying is that for you to have that aspect of your life away from the farm as well, although related, obviously, to your farm?
Yeah, I don't know if it's really important. I mean, it might sound a bit weird, but I think is it important? I don't think it doesn't feel like it's important for me to do those things. It's more, I find it quite fun. It's interesting. I'm curious about how people respond. I don't do it to get a response. I'm always curious about how it lands. I just think it doesn't feel like a responsibility, but why wouldn't I share what we're doing if I feel that it's going to benefit someone in some way? And look, we, you know, it's not all beer and Skittles. We often get, you know, people grumbling about something we've done or shouldn't have done or negative comments. I just don't really worry about it too much, to be honest. But I think I don't feel that I have a responsibility to do social media. It's more, it's a tool. It does benefit our business. It gives me reach if I do have messages or, you know, for the podcast, for instance, or running workshops, biodynamic workshops, or other things that we're involved in. It's a great tool for that. And I think, you know, especially if you're in the value adding sort of part of the farm business, then you might be still commodity farming and selling sheep and cattle and wool to, you know, into the market, the common market. But if you're looking to value add any of those products, I think, you know, I don't know how you do it without social media and giving your potential customers a sense of who you are and why you're doing it. And, you know, it's interesting for people. It gets back to that question earlier on, Matthew, about, you know, everyone's a foodie. You know, it just gives a touch point. I think it's important that I'm not advocating children watch a whole lot of social media, but, you know, if parents are enthused about farming and where their food comes from, then it's hopefully going to rub off on their kids and they might make a few treks out to a farm and show their kids where food's made and just some basic stuff like that. And I have to say, one of the most wonderful things I get to do is when I bump into people. I ran into a fella in Bunnings in Mirigong the other day. Ian, I forgot your name right, Ian. And he said, I was listening to your podcast a couple of years ago and, you know, I think it was just before COVID and he was in Sydney and was he in Melbourne? I can't remember. But he's moved to the Highlands and he's now selling beef and honey and all sorts of lamb and things. Like, I just love hearing those stories. I don't even know Ian, and we bumped into me in the Bunnings, and I just love hearing those things. And so I couldn't hear those stories, and I couldn't feel the warmth of those journeys that people are on unless, you know, I've put myself out there a bit and do the podcast or do social media stuff. It's one of my favourite things, I've got to say, Matthew, is hearing how what we're doing here is impacting people in a positive way to have changed their life. And it doesn't mean you've got to go and buy a farm and move your whole life, but that has happened. I'll tell you what, a lot of people have said, look, you know, I've listened to this and I've seen that, not just me, but all the other wonderful people doing similar things in agriculture. It's changed their life, you know, and that's wonderful. That's just wonderful stuff. Wonderful to hear. It's a real privilege to hear that.
That's brilliant, Charlie. And, you know, thank you for all you do for the industry. I think you're a cracking advocate for the industry, and the more people like you out there sharing your story, I think the better for everybody. I also love your look, Charlie. I can't let you go through this interview without discussing your look. Normally, sort of the shirt undone. Would you say it's a cravat, a necktie, or?
Oh, bandana. I guess I've got a. I mean, what color? I've got a violet one on today.
Beautiful.
It's usually red. Yeah, I guess it's something I do wear every day. I feel like I'm nude if I don't have one on, to be honest. I just started wearing it from a practical point of view probably, well, it was before my son, probably 9 years ago, 10 years ago maybe, just wearing it for a practical purpose. You know, winter, it keeps you a little bit warm around the neck, even though I'm quite furry around there. Every little bit of warmth and burrow is helpful. And then summer, you know, it's always handy for the dust and that sort of thing. And then it just became a thing I wore, you know, outside of the paddock. And then, I don't know, as I said, it'd feel weird not to be wearing it. And I don't know, I don't necessarily keep the buttons down low on purpose. I tend to do that. Probably all my chest hair pushing through the buttons, Matthew. I think that's what it is.
Well, I often think you're the sharpest dressed man at certain events and conferences, Charlie, when you're there. So good for you.
Well, thank you.
The field day. So we're recording this on the 27th of November. The field day at Charlie's place is happening on the 10th of December. People can register up until the 8th of December. So anybody who's now listening to this and is interested in going along to see Charlie and his property, please register now. And you can do that via the Atlas Carbon website. Are you looking forward to the field day, Charlie, and inviting people onto the property?
Yeah, no, I am. We often hold field days or workshops here, so I'm not. It's not new to me to do that, but certainly this particular, you know, the focus is soil carbon and our project and what we've done and hosted with Atlas Carbon. So yeah, very much looking forward to it. We had 43 mils of rain the other day. Excuse me. So that's going to hopefully the slight green tinge that it's producing will stay there for the next few weeks. Yeah, it starts at 10. I think registrations or just turn up for a cup of tea at 9:30. I think it'll kick off at 10 for a couple of hours in our shearing shed. And there'll be, I think, myself and Colin Bart Davidson, Cole Phelan and myself will be answering questions. Whether it's a panel session or not, that probably may be how it'll turn out. So a couple of hours of that, bit of history on, you know, the project and what we do. There'll be lunch, so it's fully catered. Bring a chair, but you don't have to bring tea or coffee or sandwiches. It'll all be done for you and when you arrive. And then from 1 till 3, there'll be a paddock walk. I think the boys are going to bring a soil corer, so they'll pull a core, as they say, somewhere nearby, so we don't have to drive too far or at all. Bart will take us through that and more questions. So, yeah, look, we're really looking forward to it. I think there's a few light refreshments at 3 o'clock, Matthew, whatever that might mean. So I'm looking forward to it. It'll be fun. Hopefully the weather's fine. It'll get me cleaning the shearing shed out, that's for sure. That's probably another good aspect of it.
Brilliant. Well, good luck with it. I hope it goes really well. I'm sure it will. We need to wrap this up, and I'm just trying to think about how best to do that. And I would just like to get your thoughts on the future of your property there. You sort of mentioned succession earlier when thinking about a soil carbon project, specifically in the 20 to 25 year timeframes. What do you see for the future of your property? Are you thinking that far ahead, Charlie, or is that something you're not considering? What's in the future for you for the next 10 years, would you say?
10 years, that's a good horizon. Look, I think my role in the business needs to change. I'm looking to change that now and be less manager. I'm hands-on manager. I've got a Brock and operations manager, and so he's doing a lot of the day-to-day stuff. I need to step a bit further out of the business into some more higher level things and more strategy. I tend to sort of fall back into operation stuff because I quite enjoy doing it. So from a business point of view, you know, my role, that'll change. I'll be spending more time off farm, I suspect. Just, you know, I love traveling. The podcast is something I want to keep doing, and that does take me away from the farm whilst I do interviews here, whether that's overseas or just nationally or whatever. You know, that's where I see myself going. In terms of the landscape and the farm and, you know, the business here, we're looking at agritourism sort of development. That's something that is definitely in the pipeline. There's so many different ways and versions of that, of course, but we've got a few ideas we're thinking about. Yeah, and that would revolve around education and entertainment and just having facilities to host different events and things and people, whether it's a couple or it's a couple of hundred. I'm always thinking about my kids. You know, Lilla's 15 and Lordy's 8. And, you know, what are they going to do? I'm not hell-bent on them coming back here or else. You know, it's more I'd like to create a business or develop and a business so that at the time in their lives where they might choose to come back here, there's a legacy and it's an asset. It's not a liability for them, and I don't want them feeling guilty. But I have a pretty clear vision of how I see my life playing out and where, and it's here and it's away, but it's my sanctuary is still Hanamino, and you know my family's here, and there's culture and it's dynamic. And there are more people in the business. I mean, I'd even consider profit sharing and those sort of things and bringing other people into the business if they were contributing, you know, and shared our values. So that might sound a bit vague, Matthew, but it's pretty clear in my mind is, you know, what I see 10, 15, 20 years down the track, you know, and I think about that every day about, you know, whether it's the oak trees I plant, under whose, you know, the shade people will be sitting in many years to come, or the fence that goes up, or the production system we're creating, you know, and trying to keep it simple but dynamic. Yeah, I don't know. I hope I answered your question. It was probably a bit vague, but it's in my mind it's pretty clear. You know, I'm not going anywhere. I want to travel, but I also want this to be ever-evolving, ever-changing, ever-regenerating, and, you know, until I'm no longer here.
Great way to finish, Charlie, and fantastic to reflect on your legacy. Charlie's podcast, if anyone is interested, is called The Regenerative Journey, and you can find it on all main podcast providers. Lots and lots of episodes and well worth a listen. Charlie, I just want to say thank you for your time and sharing your insights and experience and knowledge. It was great catching up with you, and thank you again, and look forward to seeing you soon.
Thanks, Matthew. Appreciate your time and all the best for your podcast. I'm looking forward to not so much listening to mine, but all the others.
Brilliant stuff. Thanks, Charlie. All the best.
Thanks, Matthew.
To learn more about how Atlas Carbon helps graziers investigate their soil carbon potential, visit the Atlas Carbon website. And to learn more about how Meyer Grazing helps livestock producers make great grazing decisions, visit the Meyer Grazing website.